genre bet on this thing even tells me the date. December 18th, 2007, in Bob Bank's second floor office in the administration building. And thanks, Bob, for agreeing to do an interview. I wanted to talk to you about a little bit about the history of the Fankley grievance procedure, which is having its 35th birthday year. A little bit about some of the people who have been FGOs, and I have a list if we want to refer to it. And depending on time we have today or another session, talk a little bit about the subject of possible revisions of the FGP. And then somewhat from my background, because of my interest in labor relations, I'm also interested, you've had some involvement with some of the unionization efforts, either the direct attempts to unionize faculty three times, or the current efforts that are going on campus now about maybe the fixed-term faculty or some subset of them might unionize, or the grad students did unionize and you negotiated with them, and you've also had some relations with some of the other unions because of their coalition relating to healthcare bargaining or other things. So if that's fine, and we'll get to the permission form in a second. So if you don't mind, just a bit of background, you were born when and where, and just a little bio in terms of what got you to Michigan State and labor relations.
Okay. I was born in Battle Creek, Michigan, on the 18th of January, which is a month from now, 1936. I stayed there a very short period of time because my father worked for General Mills and lost his job in the second recession of the 1930s, you know, not the Big Bang, but the blip that occurred after the mid portion of that decade, and we moved
37-38.
Yeah. And we moved eastward to a number of locations, and he finally settled in northern New Jersey, in a town called Montclair.
Born in Battle Creek. Give me the date again. I got it. Scooped
January 18th, 1936.
Right.
And
in some people call that the Roosevelt Recession, or
that's right. Yeah, the second recession, not the Big Bang in the early 30s, but the downward dip, which was really then overwhelmed by war activities and the U.S. entering the war in 1941, World War II. Really grew up in northern New Jersey after a series of stops. He ended up working for Pillsbury Mills. He was a sales representative and ended up really being responsible for the catchment area for sales for Pillsbury in the greater New York area, which in those days took a lot of driving around because you would visit individual stores and ask about their service.
Did he have a car?
He had a car, yeah, that was provided him by the company. And interestingly, based on his prior experience, he came to Montclair and he said, I will never buy another house because I'm going to get moved. They've moved me twice after very short periods of time. And he built a house in the Boston area and then almost immediately got transferred. And as a result, he lived in a rental house his whole life because he never moved after that. And he never bought the house. And curiously, an elderly couple owned the house. The daughter, the son, was a dentist, and he was pleased to have someone to look after it. And he rented it for $100 a month. And the rent never changed from 1941 until about 1960. So as a result of all of that, I went through all the levels of school in Montclair from elementary to middle to high school and graduated there.
Did you have siblings?
I had a sister who's now deceased, but she was 4 years older than I. And she had the same experience in terms of I think she probably went to kindergarten in Boston, the Boston area. But beyond that was wholly in the Montclair school systems. Montclair is an interesting town. It's a mixture of a section called Upper Montclair, which is very, very wealthy location, and people, it's 15, 18 miles from New York, so there's a lot of commuting into the city. And then there is a less well-off economic section, which is Montclair, but the community as a whole is a very diverse community and has a long time reputation for good race relations. And in fact, when I went to high school, of course, the elementary schools were residentially situated, as was the what we would call here the middle school. And there wasn't much diversity there. They tend to be bifurcated. But by the time I got to high school, 40% of the enrollment was African American.
What percent?
40%.
Wow.
And
where were they coming from?
They were coming from Montclair, you see, which was the...
I meant what kind of jobs were their parents in, do you think?
Well, all sorts of jobs.
City jobs?
City jobs to a very considerable degree.
Okay.
Jobs in the school system,
mm-hmm.
jobs with federal employment, post office, those sorts of jobs.
Okay.
But one had a series of friends and relations which have gone back. Fortunately, many of the folks are dead at this
point. Do you have connections with anybody from those days?
Not really. No,
okay.
No.
No high school or college or, I mean, school reunions?
They do try to...
But you haven't been one. Okay.
Although I did put an entry in the updated version of the directory, which will
uh-huh.
shortly, and it'll be interesting to see where people are.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people are still there. A lot of people
living
are,
still in the county,
and a lot of people have married classmates. You know, the high school sweetheart was married, and so on. There was one fellow who I got to know quite well, who at age 16 or 17 was in the triathlon in the Olympics, mm-hmm. and he finished in fourth spot. His name was Aubrey Lewis, and he went to Notre Dame on a football scholarship.
Okay.
And was in the black years, if that's not a good title, I guess. But the dismal years of Notre Dame, when they had a decade in which they had an absolutely terrible football record.
That sounds like this last year.
Yeah, but it went on went on for a longer period of time, and he was on that.
Huh.
And I had an interesting experience. I didn't just waste
time.
But an interesting experience
it's funny.
Of looking at the AMC, the movie channel, and they uh-huh. were having films on great sports figures. So they had a film on Newt Rockne, and then mm-hmm. they finished 10 minutes early, and then they were doing Lou Gehrig. Well, they had filler. And the filler in between had three newsreels on football.
Okay.
One was Michigan State playing some team in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
with Earl Morrill as quarterback.
So okay,
that was the link. The second film was footage of Notre Dame, and this fellow, Aubrey Lewis, is shown doing a sweep mm-hmm. around right end and running 25 yards in for a touchdown. And the third one was a Princeton-Harvard football game,
okay.
Which a fellow by the name of Royce Flippin, who was 3 years ahead of me in high school, who was the last single-wing running back
uh-huh.
in the history of American football. And there's a picture of him running in for a score. And he is now retired, but was for many years the athletic director at MIT. And so here juxtaposed are these folks connected either with high school on mm-hmm. the one hand or MSU on the other hand.
Amazing.
Just pure serendipity.
Funny.
Aubrey Lewis ran the kind of PAL program for the greater New York area. You know,
okay, police leagues,
police
that supporting
athletic league
kids.
And he also did the broadcast. They had a high school football game of the day.
Okay.
You know, and they would try to pick up matchups that were teams that were either you know historic combatants or had good records, and he would do the advertising there. He died in his early 60s. So probably 7 or 8 years ago. But he, like the others, interestingly, married his high school sweetheart. They were married for, you know, 35 or 40 years. He never played pro football because I think he damaged a knee or something in his last year of fame and just never.
Funny.
But he was an extraordinary athlete. He would, in high school was about 6 feet tall and he weighed about 215 pounds. And he could run the 100-yard dash in full football equipment in 9.8 seconds. So if he broke through the line, and they tried to stuff him, you see, to catch him. And the high school football team had an extraordinary record at something it lost 3 or 4 games in 10 years and was the perpetual state champion. It lost so irregularly or so infrequently that people would sort of remember you know, we lost to Columbia and so-and-so high, or we lost to East Orange in, you know, another year and so on. That was sort of interesting. Then I went south to school at Washington Lee University, which was kind of serendipity because I was encouraged to think about applying there by some friends who'd been a year ahead of me, one of whom had gone there. And then won a fellowship, which was to encourage teachers to stay in the South. And there was a fellowship program there, and I won that. And the requirement was you had to go 1 year to the South in the university. I went to the University of North Carolina for a year, interested in labor issues along the way, in terms of both high school involvement and in university, particularly university involvement. And then regrettably...
Because labor was the issue of the day in terms of in the popular, a lot of things happening?
Yeah, a lot of things happening, but also a personal sense of concern about, you know, particular issues and cases that arose in corporate America and so on.
Were you interested in the law?
Not really.
Okay.
I was interested more on the economic side of
things. And public policy?
Public policy. Uh-huh. I did a degree in economics as an undergraduate. And then went to, again, economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There were two folks that did labor issues there. One was an old guy who regrettably, in the spring of the year, passed away, a fellow by the name of Harry Wolf, who was one of the chief architects of the Railway Labor Act, one of the, a colleague of Harry Millis, if that name means anything to you. And he had been gassed in World War One, and he always puffed and wheezed. And, and finally he went... Another was a fellow by the name of Paul Guthrie, who was a very successful arbitrator as a faculty member. And he left his role as a faculty member, went full-time into arbitration. And if you recall historically, this would be in the late 1950s, economics was really in the midst of a mathematical revolution. And there were some questions along the way of whether they would replace these people. Well, I wasn't interested in those kinds of topics. I mean, I did the basic micro and macro theory that, you know, you had to do to stay in the program. And pure serendipity, there was a visiting economic historian, a fellow by the name of Jim Potter from the LSE, who was there visiting for a year, and he said, have you ever thought of going to Britain to do graduate school? And I said, no, I hadn't. And he said, well, I think you would do pretty well. Your academic record is quite strong. And suggested I put into to Oxford, Cambridge, and the LSE. And I think I got admitted at Oxford, and I got admitted at LSE. And probably on reflection, that was a mistake relative to going to Oxford, because Hugh Clegg, whose name you probably know, Alan Flanders, whose name you probably know, were just on the initial phases of building up their reputation and involvement at Nuffield College. It might have been a more interesting experience, but I ended up going to the LSE, where Ben Roberts was really my thesis advisor. He was a fairly prominent name in the field. And Henry Phelps Brown, who was you know, the kind of dean of labor economists in, in Britain. And so I went there worked for a time, in addition to studying, through links that I got because I linked up with the Workers' Educational Association, and actually would go to some classes that were offered in London by a fellow who was very popular, part of the London extramural delicacy.
Who's that?
His name was Jimmy Carruthers. He was a Scotsman who drank himself to death. So he had a short but influential career. But the real benefit is that you ended up sitting in a class and engaging in discussion with these trade union guys, all of whom had left school at 14, who'd read and participated and argued and developed, you know, really engaged in these discussions. I remember having a discussion with a guy who was the chief steward at Thrupp and Maberly, which was up in North London, which is one of the largest automotive component firms, talking about floating exchange rates and pros and cons. But he knew all this.
He knew what he was talking about.
He knew exactly what he was talking about.
Very funny.
Part of that connection, suggestions by Carruthers, and then you sort of build up. I ended up doing a fair amount of summer school teaching for unions. I taught for the Transport and General Workers.
For the Worker Association?
Well, no, actually they ran their own summer program.
The unions ran
Yeah. But again, you had people that were kind of fungible that did.
But they would connect with LSE in some.
Not really. This was sort of something that just sort of grew up on its own.
So they'd pay you directly.
Yeah, they'd pay directly for doing things in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the transport in general would rent for almost all the summer of the Royal Agricultural College at Cirencester down in southeast England. And they would run programs. We'd have to start each one with a speech from Frank Cousins that would sort of come and tell us that, you know, the world was a terrible place, but socialism was going to cure it, and so on.
They were pretty solidly socialist.
Oh, yeah.
At that, all of them.
Right, and they were all in the middle of a nuclear disarmament issue.
Did they have big, is this when they had big communist-socialist debates within?
Not really. That had largely faded. I mean, there were some unions, like the Electrical Trades Union, that were fairly heavily dominated by communists. There were some pockets in the Miners' Union. But generally speaking, that had sort of faded.
All faded back in the late 40s, early
50s. Yeah,
okay.
Post office workers, I did some teaching for. I'd have to go back.
Were they public employees?
Yes, yeah. POEU, Post Office Engineering Union. These were the technicians.
Did they have enabling legislation for public employees then, or was done without legislation?
Well, this was a nationalized industry.
Okay.
So it was covered by the provisions of the legislation that permitted organization for the purpose of collective bargaining.
Okay. At that point, did their non-nationalized public have much? I just can't recall how their public employment went in comparison to the U.S.
Heavily state organized, heavily centralized, so that the business of different state policies didn't apply. So electricity, gas, mining, which of course was a great issue in the election of right after World War II, was nationalized. So that almost all those industries were covered by one form or other of nationalized legislation, which had provisions for union recognition and collective bargaining. So that the experience here of para or kind of state-by-state enabling legislation really doesn't apply in that kind of setting.
But there were some public employees who didn't have union rights at that point, weren't there?
I would guess so, but I would have to go
back. Okay, doesn't matter. Anyway.
Sort of faded as part of memory.
But it's a very unionized country.
Yeah,
so
civil servants also had the same provisions, even at fairly senior levels and so on.
Okay. And so how many training programs did you do in this kind of way?
Oh, 20 or 25, something like
that.
Over
how many years?
Well, I was there from 59 to 67. Most of these were done in the first, after settling in for a year or two, in the roughly 62 to 64. And then I did fewer because in 63, I got a job at LSE. I got a faculty job there. So I was constrained.
You were teaching undergrads then?
No. The linkage, interestingly, with this work done in the summer is while I did, and the program was really developing, the joke was that I got a job because Ben Roberts was a professor, and professors needed a department, and a department needed to have someone to be ordered around by a professor. So you know, I was the only person in the department. It's now a quite large department at this particular point in time. But the program was just in the process of being developing. We didn't have a general curriculum pretty much until my last year there. But one of my major responsibilities, because I seemed to like doing it and seemed to do it reasonably well, was to be the kind of tutor for the Trade Union Studies course, which the TUC financed at LSE.
Okay. Is that self-study?
No, actually, it's a variant of I know less about it, but it's a program like those at the Meany Center.
Okay.
But these folks would compete for scholarships, which the TUC would provide.
Okay.
And they, in essence, provided full support for a year, not only to pay their tuition, but to give them subsistence.
So it's credited programming.
Yeah. Well, they never got a degree. They got a certificate at the end of it.
Okay, but it was done by the university rather than done by the union themselves.
That's right.
So it actually was much more like the MSU labor education programs.
Yeah,
certificates, not university credit.
That's true.
But it was university sanctioned. It wasn't the union's own program.
Yeah, the union was obviously interested in what was in it and so on, but it was a fairly basic. It had a series of courses and seminars on industrial relations issues. They they studied economics, industrial psychology, industrial.
So did you teach in that program then?
Yeah, I.
Okay.
And then part
but did
of
you do tests or exams, or it was non-credit still?
Well, it's a non-credit. There were no tests.
Okay.
But one of the elements of the program, which I worked with each class for 3 or 4 years on, was a series of tutorials. And they would be set a subject, or they could choose a subject from a small list, and then they'd write a paper. And I would read the paper, and then we'd sit and talk about it for a couple of hours. And what was interesting, what they might do to further develop it, what errors, and so on.
The people who got into this program were somewhat pre-screened so that they had decent writing skills, or is that something that you would teach them too?
These were extraordinary writers. These were all, without exception, school leavers at 14, but had tracked their experience in writing in terms of memoranda and collective agreements and minutes of branch meetings and so on. And yes, they are competitive. You had to be advanced by your union, which was a member of the TUC, which was true in all but a tiny number of cases. And then you had an application process that involved an essay that was reviewed, and then you had personal interviews.
Wow. And did you do interviewing?
Yes, I did interviewing. I sort of filled in for Roberts. Roberts was not increasingly less interested in that part of the work of the
He helped create this thing, though?
He was responsive. I don't recall really who...
TUC may have pressed for
it. Yeah, the TUC had pressed in terms of it. TUC gave a number of other scholarships of smaller numbers.
How many students did they have?
They range from a dozen to 15.
Okay.
They had a smaller number of scholarships at Ruskin College in Oxford, and a small other number of scholarships at the Catholic Workers College.
Where was that?
That was also affiliated with Oxford.
Okay.
And there may have been, Collie Harlech, which was affiliated with the University of, not South Wales and Monmouthshire, the other University of Wales up on the coast, up near, across the bay from Liverpool.
So what classes did you teach?
Well, again, my main involvement was with the these tutorials.
Okay.
In terms of working things through with them. There would be a series of lectures, which increasingly I gave some of them. The initial period, Roberts gave most of them. And then there was a follow-up class, which was sort of a seminar. And there were discussions and arguments and issues. Roberts became increasingly conservative. He was concerned about union behavior and whether it was irresponsible.
He was
a very strong proponent of needing to establish a legal basis for industrial relations in Britain. He was a great supporter of the Heath legislation that then got withdrawn by the succeeding Labour government, which essentially was largely modeled on the Taft-Hartley Act. He argued that view strongly. These were rank and file trade union people with a lot of experience in the ranks and so on, and they were not terribly enthusiastic about that point of view. So it was sort of, and they didn't sit on their hands.
Is this the stuff that then led into the major discussion, debate, fights in the late 60s, early 70s in Britain for the
There was a Royal Commission on Trade Unions Employers Association in 1968. The Labour government was in power, the Wilson government was in power, and they tried to introduce a number of modest adjustments in labor law, which the union stoutly opposed, and the government withdrew them.
But then they got big changes in the mid-70s.
Yeah, with Margaret Thatcher's selection of the conservative majority and her selection as prime minister.
But what you're describing in the 50s really is part, intellectually, connects to these reforms of the 70s.
Yeah, this was an ongoing debate, and it was a period of time in which there was a high incidence of conflict in Britain. Almost all of it was unofficial strikes, because the union structure was really not malleable in terms of meeting needs and requirements, because essentially it was either craft or sectionally oriented, mm-hmm. so that you had a number of unions that were essentially industrially based but would be in competition with one another. The classic example is Ford's Dagenham plant, which is close to London, in the early 1960s, where they had 39 unions that represented their employees, five or six of which were all general unions or industrial unions. Uh-huh. And a lot of people, and they were not really well connected with union structure. So what you had, particularly in autos and some of the other industries, a natural development in which folks from the individual unions worked together to press a case vis-a-vis mm-hmm. employers, and they worked together. Once doing it ad hoc, they then created an organization.
Okay.
That organization wasn't responsible to any union, any right. individual union.
Well, a lot of this relates to then the shop steward movement.
Yes, absolutely.
Which, yeah.
Yeah, and this is connected with that.
Sort of an earlier phase of that.
Yeah. I also did some work with unions in ongoing in terms of shop steward training. I had one interesting experience. I did one after the midnight shift at Dagenham. You got uh-huh. got on the underground and went out uh-huh. there, and you started. These folks came off at midnight. Mm-hmm. We started at 12:45. Mm-hmm. We went for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. It wasn't good for my health in the longer term to sort of turn your life around because I was doing a full-time job.
You got to meet yeah. some different people.
But they are very interesting people. Enterprising, bright.
Now, did you do any research on this while you were doing this training and coordinating? Or did that not really connect to what you were doing in your own schooling?
Well, I was there in the PhD program, and I wrote a PhD dissertation, but it wasn't on this.
But you didn't study or write about these labor relations topics in this way.
Not the shop stewards movement and those kinds of issues. I ended up doing essentially an industry study. As many things in life, it turns on accessibility. Mm-hmm. And I worked on a not an important industry, but a fairly small one, which was the baking industry. And uh-huh. the critical question was how, in light of technological and economic change mm-hmm. in that industry, what sort of impact did it have on union structure and bargaining procedure? Yep. And essentially, it involves a lot of essentially historical research. Mm-hmm. Having read every issue of The Journeyman Baker from 1881 to present, I can tell you it took a lot of painstaking work because they had verbatim uh-huh. reports of their executive wow. committee minutes. That's where they appeared. You got your Journeyman Baker and you opened up to page 3.
But this was this technological change and how it affects labor relations was a big interest in the U.S. in the yeah. late 60s. Yeah. Also, I mean, yeah. Ina Hardin did a lot of stuff related to that here. So.
Yeah, the theme here, so, to some degree in Britain, was the concern that it would result in the destruction of jobs.
Uh-huh.
My interest was not so much that, because there was not a lot of evidence of that. It's really the question in the institutional terms, in terms of both. The union, as you would guess, when it started, was just a plethora of little local organizations.
Right.
Because the labor market and the product market, mm-hmm. the bakery products, is right. very decentralized. Well, in the 20s and 30s, you had the big mass production bakeries emerge mm-hmm. With a lot of technology. That clearly had an impact on the union. And there was an ongoing struggle mm-hmm. of whether the locals would cede authority mm-hmm. to the central entity.
I'm going to pursue one more question. In the U.S., those kind of industries, bakery included, but certainly very much in some others, but organized that way, were a major problem in terms of corruption and mafia, or however you want to phrase it, kind of influence within the labor relations world because of how employers were organized and then how unions yeah. did. Was that an issue in Britain or not?
Minimal issue.
Okay. Is that because there never was much of that kind of organized crime influence?
I think largely that was.
In the society as a whole?
In the society as a whole.
Okay.
There's now, in recent years, there's been mm-hmm. the emergence, particularly from immigrants from Eastern Europe and Russia and so on. Mm-hmm. But historically, in the time period,
it was a non-issue.
It's really a non-issue.
Okay. Yeah.
told you more than you probably wanted.
No, I'm more than fascinated with. I'm more than interested in all these topics, so I don't really have any reason to want us to not continue having fun. Let's just finish this, and then I want to set up for the next time in terms of the grievance procedure, if that's okay. Totally shifting, but what else, if we were to pursue a little bit more about telling me about this LSE time, would you want to tell me? Any, this is a time when you make a family change in your life?
Yeah.
And go from being single to not single?
I met my wife through really a colleague who I shared an apartment with, who was dating a young woman who was a friend of hers, and we went on a blind date. And so that emerged. She had come from Wales, was a graduate of the University of South Wales in Monmouthshire, and had come to London looking for work, and worked in various spots. She was working as a kind of staff assistant in the Royal College of Surgeons, which happened to be just around the corner from the LSE, although at the time I met her, I didn't know what her work experience was.
How long were you in London then?
We were there, I was there from 59 to 67.
Okay.
And so we met probably in the early 60s. She almost immediately thought this might prove to be something serious, and she thought she better go and find out something about the United States, because she thought that at some point I might want to return, which was a wise judgment. And there was an ad in the London Observer put in by the Camelback Inn in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And it was advertising for young British women to come as waitresses.
Mm-hmm.
And they would pay the airfare out, and they gave them a return trip ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and a number of her friends signed up and went.
She convinced other people to do it
right
there?
Yeah, it was a great opportunity, because in that point, British pay was very low.
Uh-huh.
And thinking about coming to the United States and visiting and staying there, even in a work situation, was just beyond the dreams of most people. So she went there for a period of time. As you would guess, it waned somewhat quickly.
Where does this take you? Where do you live and work?
Where do I live and work?
She.
She, in Scottsdale, Arizona.
And where do you live?
She lived there. She lived.
You find your own apartment?
No. I stayed in Britain.
No,
she
I understood that.
Yeah.
Did she just find an apartment on her own, or did this employer connect
with
something?
No, the employer had housing for staff, so she went there.
Okay.
And she worked there for some period of time, and then just packed up and said, enough's enough. And she went out to the West Coast, to San Francisco, and linked up with the fellow who was who then subsequently came to New York, but was the editor of Simon and Schuster.
Hmm.
It was a Simon, Cal Simon was his name.
Hmm.
And then when he came back, they then moved their major operation to New York, and she came back with him and worked for him for a time. And then I don't know what happened, whether he moved on or she looked at other things, and she was able to exploit relations again with the young woman who introduced us. And ended up getting a job at the British Embassy in New York City.
Hmm.
And was there probably 2+ years. And then at that point, she decided to come back, and we ended up seeing one another and discovered that it was all very nice, but we ended up sort of going out to eat and going here, and we decided we should just get married. It was much cheaper than to have this endless.
So how long did you date?
Oh, well, a number of it was through the mails while she was there, like probably 3 years, but in personal terms, probably 18 months or something like that.
Very funny.
Again, I don't want to take up a lot of your time, but the interesting link is the young woman that introduced us obviously had a relationship with this fellow who I shared an apartment with, who then came back to the States after a short period of time. He, in fact, sponsored her to come to America to stay. And she ended up working almost immediately in the British Embassy, but she had also developed a relationship with a young man who was of British background but had been born in Kenya and was excellent classical pianist, but not quite excellent enough to really make his way, because you really have to be at the top of everything. So he came to the United States, and he came to the United States to link up with her and got into the advertising business, writing advertising copy and so on. And through some curious link, which I don't know the particular answer, he became involved with the Roosevelt family. And the Roosevelt family said to him, you know,
funny,
Uncle Teddy has had a number of biographies written of him, but no one has really done the proper sort of job. And by the way, we have about 8 boxes of papers that are sitting up in the attic that no one has really looked at. And would you be interested in doing this? So he did that. And he wrote volume one of Teddy Roosevelt. And he won the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, wow.
Writing it.
So this is the name of this person.
Yeah, his name is Edmund Morris, is his name.
Right, right.
Now, beyond that, in terms of his link with the Roosevelts, he became closely affiliated with a woman called Lucky Roosevelt, who was the wife of Teddy's grandson, who lived in Georgetown. And she was the diplomatic protocol officer for the Reagan administration. And Edmund got connected with the Reagans.
Okay.
And to make a long story short, he ended up as Reagan's official biographer, and he wrote a book called Dutch, which you may recall, which was very controversial in terms of his writing, because he injected himself as a character.
I have a copy of that book. It's very different. It's a very different kind of history.
And we would go and visit them.
Fascinating.
And he would say you never could get to the bottom of Reagan. He was just a kind of elusive sort of figure. Due to links also in terms of Reagan administration, his wife, Sylvia, got to be a very close personal friend with Claire Booth Luce, who was the former ambassador to Italy and was the wife of Henry Luce, who owned Time Life. And she ended up as Claire Booth Luce's official biographer and has written one volume, and there's another one that's still in the process of becoming.
Fascinating.
Edmund went back after he did Dutch and wrote volume two of Teddy Roosevelt. So it's now a 2-volume set.
Right.
Very curious in terms of this serendipical sort of arrangements.
Did you guys keep any connections with?
Yeah, we would visit them because we would go. We went when our daughter was looking at university. She went and visited Georgetown, so we were in town. I went on a university reunion once. We went through. You know, I went to school in Virginia, and on the way to Washington, and we would stop.
How nice.
They live in Mark Hatfield's house, who's the former senator from Oregon, I guess.
In Georgetown?
No, it's right next to the Supreme Court.
Oh.
And so he said, you know, we were here the other night, and Reagan sort of looked out the window.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
To finish up another loose end, you guys get married when and where then?
We got married in 1963. We got married in St. Mary's in Cadogan Street, which is right behind Harrod's apartment store, you know, just off Sloane Street down in Chelsea, down in, I guess it's not Chelsea, down in Knightsbridge. And we then got an apartment and lived for the period of time we were there, which was 63 to 67. In an apartment up in Highgate, which is on the other side of the Hampstead Heath. Hampstead is on the other side, and Highgate Village is on the other. Highgate Village is interesting because it has a cemetery that goes down the hill. It's the location where Karl Marx was buried, and there's this great head of Karl Marx. And so when my son was born there in 65, Claire would push him in his pushchair, and they'd go down in the park, and there'd be all these Russian, you know, people with medals, and admirals in general. They'd all come and pay obeisance to the tomb of Karl Marx.
It's like people go to Chicago to the Haymarket. Kind of thing.
Yeah,
all these old lefties kind of thing.
Yeah, sorting out. Hilarious. So then the last phase of all of this is we soon realized that even though you got your £60 a year London allowance, you know, the salary is absolutely flat, whether you were a philosopher or an ancient historian or a economist in Britain. Everyone earned the same rate. You might earn a little bit on the side, but there was very little of that. And if you lived in London, you got £60 a year more on top of that, $120. Well, London house prices were not as elevated then as they were today, but they were just beyond the pale. And so you'd have to end up sort of buying a slum and sort of redoing it. And so I thought I'd best look around. Luckily for me, who was on a sabbatical, who I got to know quite well at the LSE for a
Who?
year, was a fellow by the name of Bob McCursey, whose
Oh,
name you certainly
sure.
recognize, who was at that point not yet the director of the school at Cornell. He was still at Chicago and hadn't gone on to MIT. He had just was just in the process of finishing up the book that made him famous with Walton and McCursey. Can't recall what that's called. Behavioral Theory of Labor Negotiations. He gave an interesting series of lectures on productivity bargaining, which was an active topic in Britain at that point, which is really one of the bargaining relationships that he talked about in terms of his particular book. Very nice fellow, very unassuming. I don't know whether you know him or not.
I know who he is.
Yeah, but
I've met him, but
he's a very interesting. Actually, he came and did a review of the school here some year. He called me up sometime about quarter to 10. I said, "What the hell are you still doing in your office?" I said, "Who is this?" He said, "It's Bob McCursey. I'm just here. I've been."
Well, Joel Gershenfeld was very connected with those guys,
From when he was at the MIT later.
right?
So he said, "Well, if you're interested in going back, I've got a bunch of links, and let me at that point, send some notes or make some calls because he would go back and visit. And one of the places he called was MSU, and one of the people he talked to was Jack Stieber. And so I then came in the winter, just about this time of the year in '66, and I went to Rutgers, and I can't remember the guys there who ran the labor program service there. He's now probably dead. He's certainly retired. I talked to Joe Shister at Buffalo, which was still called the University of Buffalo, who's a name that you may back on him
Don't
next
know,
time,
don't know.
labor relations guy.
I'm still trying to think of the Rutgers name.
And I talked to Stieber as well. And it was largely an informal kind of interview. Graham Reed, whose name you may or may not know, was a labor economist from Scotland who ended up as a very senior civil servant in the Thatcher administration and wrote.
Wells Kennedy?
No.
He's Rutgers guy.
Yeah, if you said the name, I would.
Okay. Wells Kennedy might be younger. Maybe he's older than me, but okay. Never mind. Sorry.
I might think of the name in a moment. But in any event, Graham Reed was here as a visitor, on a visiting appointment. And I had known him because one of the elements that helped me connect with the profession there is that Ben Roberts had been selected the president of BIR, I don't know what the rest of the acronym was, the British Industrial Relations Association, it's sort of a minor equivalent of IRRA. And there had to be then someone who was the secretary who kept the records and so on, made sure that Rivette got a Dunning letter if he had to foot his
Understood.
fees and so on. So
Gotcha.
I ended up in that role, and so that one would get to know
Gotcha.
most of the folks. And the industrial relations profession at that point was fairly narrow.
You talking about in Britain?
It talks about in Britain in terms of people. It's now expanded quite dramatically, particularly with the human resource sort of dimension, which has grown obviously here as well as there. But you'd go to a meeting and Roberts would be there, Alan Flanders would be there, Hugh Clegg would be there, Donald Robinson, who regretfully died at a very early age, was a labor economist from Scotland. Graham Reed would be there. Bert Turner, I don't know whether that name means anything to you.
No, I don't
But
think
in
so.
any event, there were about, 8 or 10 of them. Then there were a bunch of people who were in their departments and so on. And so in being involved with organizational activities and having to show up and be there was the way in which one became connected. The detour on Graham Reed is that Graham Reed thought the kinds of things I was doing, talking about mm-hmm. writing, my general involvement mm-hmm. with these union programs of one kind mm-hmm. or another, thought I was a pretty good person. So he sort of said to Jack, you know, this is a good opportunity here.
Okay. Well, let's save all the MSU stuff, because yeah. we're never going to do that. Sure. We won't have time. Did both you and it's very personal, but did both you and Claire come into getting married there that you were Catholics from your own family's background?
No, she was. I wasn't. I converted to Catholicism shortly. Again, I'm not good on particular dates, but sometime in the early to mid 1960s.
But her part of Wales was a Catholic enclave within
But the history of it is that her parents' parents had migrated from Ireland to Wales in the 1880s and 1890s, and they were uh-huh. well-established Catholic family.
Gotcha.
And Claire has hundreds of relatives in Ireland.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a very strong, the name is Neville, which is an Irish name,
okay.
and very well connected in that regard.
Okay. Another little loose end that I was trying to, so when did you actually finish your degree?
65.
Okay. And when you were doing things, either the things directly for the unions in worker ed, or doing the LSE coordinating and the program that you were describing, did you have any knowledge of American or other labor workers' education at that time?
Yeah, generally speaking. There is a piece that goes back to the California Journal called Industrial Relations, which was written in 1966, and it was a special mm-hmm. Issue on labor education.
Okay.
Fred Haler actually wrote the piece on the United States, and I wrote the piece on Britain, and I can't remember who else.
Do you have that somewhere so I can borrow it? Give me the reference at some point.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure it's 1966, so it would be one of the issues. And I've got all my stuff at home now, so
okay.
I have to pluck it out.
That's okay.
But I didn't. I you know, like many of these things, you end up with 800 off prints, and I got rid of most of those because I really only need one copy.
Understood. I didn't know that part
so,
of your career.
So I guess in that sense, I had some feeling and understanding, as well as, you know, general reading and, that one would do on the American stuff.
And my last little sort of your Britain phase, was any of the work with unions in education, whether higher or K-12, whatever would be the core, I know that their system doesn't work the same,
yeah.
but was any of it with organized labor that related to education?
You know, these would be people who would be drawn, such as teachers.
Yeah, union leaders of that sort? Not really.
Not really.
Okay. No. Okay.
They were.
Because a lot of your U.S., a lot of your MSU things related to unionism and education.
Yeah.
And
no,
I was just curious. You did a lot of union stuff. I was curious if there had ever been any.
Those unions, National Union of Teachers, and there's a confluence of three or four of them,
mm-hmm.
while they were members of the TUC, there was a kind of arm's length relationship
uh-huh.
because a good chunk of their membership said, well, you know, an association is fine, but being, you know, with the horny-handed sons of toil or something.
Well, that's part of what I was thinking about, because in some of them ended up in some of the professional union associations or whatever ended up not affiliating at all with the general labor movement, and then they ended up with some of these independent associations, and so I was just curious if you related to
them. Yeah, no, there's a very, very strong tradition of TUC being the only game in town for the Central
okay.
Labor Federation, and there've never been any questions of, you know, people withdrawing or
okay.
being expelled and so on.
Okay.
The Electrical Trades Union was expelled for a period of time because of communist domination. It was the issue over fiddling elections and not really running, you know, internal democracy procedures appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay. So want to set up for our next time? I got some things to ask to set up for our next visit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Should I write these down?
No, I'm going to just hand you or ask if you want some things or not.
Okay.
We can just go the next time. It's going to be in January. And continue on your career, or I can stop your career for a second to ask you about the grievance procedure. We can figure that out.
It's your choice.
Whenever we do the grievance procedure, do you want beforehand to look at some documents, or would you rather not? For example, I have this list of the grievance officials.
That would be helpful.
Okay. I have a copy of the first annual report of the office. Actually, I have every one of them, but I don't think you want to look at every one. But would it be useful to look at one of them?
Probably.
Okay.
It'd be interesting for you to comment. Is the format of them dramatically different then than they are now? There have been a few things that have been added. This business of who wins and who loses, I think, was a Rubner initiative. So it probably wasn't there in the first report.
The reports of Bruce Miller to today isn't all that different. This first report of Michael Harrison is very different. And so he has 10 pages of narrative, and he has no model. And so it's much more verbatim kind of a thing for a few cases.
Yeah.
Whereas Bruce then does a process that is so similar that it's kind of cute. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. Although, as you say, it doesn't have the same kind of trying to say wins losses, which is of some interest. So I will give you some of those. I did want to talk to you about this revision of the FGP and/or users manual. I could leave you a copy of that if that's helpful.
I mean, I have one somewhere, but
that's fine.
Probably make sure I have the most up-to-date one because I think it is a work in progress, right?
I can comment about that in a second. There was also Mike Rubner's memorandum to me on his way out with his suggested revisions.
Oh, that would be interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that.
Well, you were copied on it, but it's been a long time. Yeah. It was June of 04.
Yeah.
So
well,
I was wondering if those were things you
those,
might...
Those would be useful.
Okay. That would be fun.
I don't know...
I'll turn this off.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to comment about... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what is your interest in the nature of the commentary, if any, on the past FGOs?
Oh, I had a couple... I've several interests here. One is this interest in more general about the procedure. The procedure and the history of the procedure and the people. And partly I was hoping to do something, and I don't know if it's going to be doable by the end of the year, but a model would be Stan Soffen on the Ombuds did a kind of a brief history that ended up, I don't know if, where it ended up, but he did kind of a history of the office for its 40th. I originally thought maybe I could do something like that for the history of the first 35 years, and it'd be, I don't know how many pages, 10,000 words, something probably for in-house. Maybe we could, I don't know who would be interested in publishing it, but a combination of review of some documents and some comments from the previous FGOs, yourself, there are a couple other people, Keith. Had something to do with starting the process, Keith Grody, so I was going to talk to him. Mm-hmm. Kind of a modest history of the procedure in the office, okay? So that was one purpose. And so it was only, I've interviewed Lash, I did quite a few years ago, about a variety of things, but including about his FGO stuff. So and I just chatted with Bruce Miller. And I was planning to talk to Rubner and Harrison, so that would get me most of Fred Williams just recently passed away, so that's not possible.
Well, I have impressions of all of them.
Right, and
there are some things that people could do better, and there's some elements of their involvement which are strengths.
And I have no reason to interview you on tape to find out how you want to critique people any more than you do in me on tape. So, but it was more in terms of trends or issues or things that I actually could use in something I might write up that I would circulate. We're not going to do post reviews of anybody in terms of their strengths and weaknesses.
I was thinking of the recent book that's recently appeared, the Jerry Ford book, you know, which he trashed all these people and said, wait until I'm gone before you publish it. And so
I didn't think that's what we would, I have no reason to know, want to know your opinions nor to tape you on that, but yeah. But it was.
But I think one of the real questions, there are really two themes that strike one. If you look at that record, you will find, leaving aside your term of office, mm-hmm. and starting, you know, at that point going backwards, there is really, there's Rubner and there's the rest of people
right.
who sort of come and go.
Right.
And one of the interesting questions is, what are the consequences of a procedure if you have someone that essentially has two or three years worth of experience, mm-hmm. with the first year being sort of learning the job and what to do, and then, you know, they get involved in one set of issues or another,
yeah.
and they move on. And
right. So anyways, the purpose of that was to write something about the history of the process and the procedure, okay? One possible audience for that might be an aspect of it, would be other institutions. We occasionally get asked about the process, somebody else thinking of doing it. I don't know if something I might do on it might be of some value there. The second purpose of doing any of this is what started out not quite a year ago now, talking about revising the user's manual. In conjunction under UCFA's oversight, in conjunction with the General Counsel Office and the Provost Office, following a series of meetings with Donna Zischke and Christine Zako and Terry Curry and myself, is now probably going to turn into a larger suggested revisions of the FGP itself. And I think you would have some thoughts and suggestions, whether that's taped or not, it's up to you. But
your comment is interesting to me because we've talked about this subject from time to time, and my recollection may be wrong. The last time we spoke, which was some time ago, that you said, I don't think we're really going to end up changing the procedure very much. It's largely going to be user's manual clarification and so on. And that tells me that something has happened between then and now, but I
yeah.
may be misremembering.
No, you're exactly right. That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I don't think either the provost or general counsel is as interested in just revising the manual, and is more thinking about let's do a bigger job. So that did change, and that was probably over. I don't know when we chatted about this last, but it was a few months ago.
Oh yeah, it was a period of time ago.
And the more we looked at it, the more it became, well, this isn't just about the inconsistencies between the manual and the procedure. And so, therefore, asking you about that would even be of more use, I think. But
the other thing that I think we've talked a little bit about is whether there's any merit, apart from the reasons that use
mm-hmm.
or the uses to
right.
which such a review might be put, as whether some updated version of the SD piece would be worth doing, because as I recall, he did
mm-hmm.
MSU as one of three or four or some additional number of places that had alternate approaches to in non-unionized settings of involving faculty issues, concerns, and complaints.
And you know, I think I lost that reference, Bob. I think you've mentioned this to me before, and I think I don't have it.
It's
who do you believe did this?
Martin Estey,
yeah.
MARTANESTY. He was
right.
at Pennsylvania. He's probably now dead. He's certainly probably retired. And it was done in the period of time when Lash LaRue was actually in place as FGO.
Well, we have two. We have Lash 1 and 2.
How long was
Lash
2?
Well, Lash 1 is 76 to 80.
And when was Lash 2?
When he takes over from Mary Brady, is 88, 89.
Yeah, I think it's the first one.
Yeah.
It's in that particular time period.
Okay.
I'm sure I have a copy of it somewhere.
76, 1976, 80.
I have to go back 80. To the archives and look. but I think probably a, and it was in a journal like Industrial Relations or.
Okay. And that is another possible use, and I was about to say, another thing I could do with this is Lira, which is what the old IRA name
yeah.
is now called Lira. In 2008, they're going to be in New Orleans. In 2009, they're in Frisco. And they just put out the request for proposals for 2009 presentations.
Yeah.
And one of the themes for 2009 is non-union grievance procedures and dispute resolution.
Seems ideal.
And so I thought maybe I could aim to do a thing for that. And I was kind of thinking doing something a little more historical, but then I got into a conversation with Rich Block, and he proposed a little different kind of a study that he'd be willing to work with me on. So I think that's another target for doing something like this, and the SD would be very useful in that way. So
my impression, again, it was certainly true at the time SD wrote, and you know, my frame of reference is essentially the CIC schools,
mm-hmm.
that MSU still is very unique in terms of the kind of system and structure that it's got.
Well, if you're right about the time frame, we're now 30 years later.
Yeah.
And my sense is that it's still unique, though maybe not quite as unique. You actually provided me something which is a review of institutions that had any kind of procedures. And when you look at that list, there are a number of places that have something, as I understood, Iowa had. That is some kind of a university ombuds.
Yeah.
Assistance for non-union employees and or students.
Of all types.
Of all types. But kind of like the mediation service would
yeah.
be if MSU didn't have a grievance procedure and an ombuds, the mediation service. And it seems like there's a number of institutions that have something like that when we're talking the non-union sector. I still have run into nobody who has what I think this looks like at MSU. To me, it's a union system, but the last step is the president instead of a third party,
yeah.
impartial. But when you really look at it as a procedure, it looks much more like a unionized grievance procedure with multiple steps and stuff than it looks like an ombuds system to me.
The other model, and again, I don't know to what extent it still holds true, but going back historically,
mm-hmm.
apart from the mediation sort of model, is that there'd be someone in the provost's office that would either have whole responsibility or significant,
okay.
be a kind of problem solver,
mm-hmm.
hearer of complaints,
yeah.
bringing parties together informally
yeah.
and so on, but not a procedure that led to a hearing
right.
and so on, but would
right.
be largely informal.
That's what I see as an ombuds
yeah.
system.
Yeah, but I don't, again,
and maybe I shouldn't use that phrase.
I haven't tracked this. Well, the ombudsman thing in many circles, academia connotes it's only for students, and that's why.
But that's what I mean. It's an all-employer,
yeah.
an all-connected,
yeah.
But not a not a
yeah.
procedure and not hearings,
yeah.
which is what I, anyways, so those seem to be the outcomes, and we're fine. We'll talk about one or both of those the next time we meet.
Yeah. Just three things to sort of remind you of. One, my memory is faded. We did talk a little bit about the guy who's now retired in psychology, who was the chair of UCFA at the time the grievance procedure was established. And I'm sitting here today, I can't remember his name.
Okay, I have a...
He came back on UCFA in the couple of years before he retired. It was a gap of almost 20 years. He was a member of the committee when obviously Mike was the FGO. He was the chair of it, actually.
Okay.
Sometime in after the turn of the century, Stan. I'll think of the name in a moment.
Yeah, well, you can let me know later. And I have.
But you can track him down fairly easy if I can get a list of the members. Donna Ziske would tell you she remembers everything.
Okay.
She knows I'm not. She's not old and decrepit like I am in terms of memory. The other thing are two elements that are worth noting. I did talk with you about this, and I don't recall the specifics, but there was an effort to make what a lot of people viewed as major changes in the grievance procedure in the mid-70s, And it went through governance, and someone urged that it be put on the agenda of the Senate meeting. And it was one of the few times that everyone showed up, because I remember it was over in a room over in the computer lab, and it was a very small room, and there was very large attendance, and there were people standing out in the hallway trying to hear what was going on. And essentially the change, whatever it was voted down. And it seems to me that if you could work through academic governance, you could find one of the very few meetings of the Senate where there was something that went on. And the third item, which does occur from time to time, if you look at the history, I'm reminded by your comment about this, like a faculty grievance. There have been issues raised from time to time whether there should be a third party arbitrator that should be the final decision maker in the procedure. And that has sort of come and gone, but not fairly recently. It goes back, I guess, you know, maybe sometime in the 90s and 80s. It sort of reappears from time to time.
It came up at the last comment about possibly unionizing, which is 81, 82.
Yeah.
Because it was done in contrast of, well, we have a grievance procedure. Well, but the final step is the employer. It's not a neutral. And that's 81, 82 is the last I remember that discussion.
Well, I think it's come up.
You're probably right. You would have heard it, and I didn't.
Probably not, you know, got much traction. I think it comes up at the time when UCFA does, as it does repeatedly, gets a decision that the president overturns, and then they say, well, what's the record in this regard? And
right.
It's all
we're in
a
that
snare
again.
And delusion.
We're
and
looking
so
at that again.
Yeah, so it does come up. You want me to sign this?
Well, yeah. Let me.
Do you want dates, addresses, cities, states?
No, I don't want all that stuff. Just today's date.
And you're, today's
you signed
date.
It. All right, I got that.
Yeah, okay.
But could you do the other one?
Oh, okay.
All
right.
I'm not sure which form.
12-18-07.
Yeah, I got that
one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. She's going to go make copies of a couple things I didn't make copy of. So this is, of course, the user's manual, the procedure, this proposed agenda of changes, and Mike Rubner's letter to me.
Do you have on your list the issues that now you think will be in play if there are particular changes in the grievance procedure? Because my recollection is that most of the lists that you compiled initially were, you know, this is ambiguous, it needs to get clarified more.
Well, it's still at that level. I mean, I have not revised this list since some of these discussions this fall have led to the, we probably just go ahead and make suggestions on FGP changes. It isn't that way, but most of them are in the sense of the kinds of issues. I mean, you know, one of the kinds of issues is about definition of administrator. And in the procedure, it's 3153. Only in the side do I make it. That was always in that way. Or defining existing policies and practice. So it was just a list of kind of issues, so it didn't matter where it was. But I think earlier the thought was you could probably just add some commentary in the user manual which would clarify that this is what it means. And I would say the last meeting of Christine, Don, and I was more like, John, why don't you just tell us what you think it should look like, and then we'll see where we're at.
Because I would say is just the reaction to the two areas that you mentioned, I can just imagine a committee and the faculty council and so on trying to parse the language of what custom and practice means and defining an administrator. Because it seems to me that you're not going to be able to totally escape from.
Thanks,
Krista. Solely at the end of the day, taking a position that the FGO has got to make an interpretation. I may be wrong, which leads me to believe that you're going to do better with a user's manual than with.
Either way, it ends up being UCFA that's going to comment.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but the user's manual is commented upon by the UCFA, And the status of the user's manual is not approval, it's a chance for them to comment. In other words, they're permitting the FGO to administer the process. In the grievance procedure language, you've got to run it through academic governance as well as UCFA.
Oh.
So it raises the
status. Oh, it's incredibly more complicated if it ends up being a FGP revision.
Yeah. Borrow your pen. Do you recall when this meeting is that, so I can look, make sure I look at these before I do my homework before you show up?
You don't need to look at them at all, too.
Well, the other question that would be helpful to me is there any of these issues that, you know, you would begin with? They look to me like they all blend, because it's going to be on the procedure, and they all have to do with the procedure, so it's looking at it in the round.
The order of those four pages of agendas was from the beginning to the end for the most part, with the only thing that deviated from that was this question about should the FGO consult with anyone before making the procedural decisions. Yeah. Otherwise, it really started with one and went to eight.
Okay. So this is one,
but this
one nine?
One eight. Oh, eight.